WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
One of the most universally asked questions about pornographic films is, do the actors really get turned on while they make the movie? One of the best-known pornographic movies of the past decade is Deep Throat. The movie starred Linda Lovelace as a woman who can't have orgasms until her doctor, played by Harry Reams, discovers that her clitoris is located in her throat. This discovery leads to many escapades with oral sex. The main character is able to take the phallus deep down into her throat by relaxing her throat muscles, hence the title Deep Throat. The star of this movie, Linda Lovelace, is with me in the studio now. In her new book, Ordeal, she makes it quite clear that she did not enjoy making Deep Throat or any of the other X-rated movies that she appeared in. She despised the Linda Lovelace persona that was forced upon her. Then why did she do it? When she was in her early 20s, after surviving a car crash that mangled her body and nearly killed her, she met a man named Chuck Traynor. His main attraction was that he could take her out of the controlling grasp of her parents. He did just that, but he also turned her into his slave. He beat her, threatened her with death if she tried to escape. He forced her into prostitution and forced her to make X-movies. The stories she tells in her book, Ordeal, are horrifying. Her book is published by Lyle Stewart Publishers. Linda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why did you want to tell the story that you tell in your book, Ordeal?
Well, I think it was very important. It was time for me to set the record straight about what really did happen to me. For a lot of various reasons, the film company that did make Deep Throat has released three others, saying that I've just released a new movie. I think for the protection of my son in his later years, I think once people realized that I was not a willing participant, but rather a victim, they will not abuse him verbally when he goes to school. And for my own head, I just got tired of hearing about, you know, pornography is a victimless crime and women are willing participants and all that. And it was time to let people know that it's not a victimless crime and I was a victim. And if I was one, then I'm sure there's others out there.
Have you been believed by most of the people who you've encountered? And I know you've been on a lot of radio and television shows mm-hmm. with call-ins and audience participation.
I have everyone that, I would say 95% of all the people I've spoken to over radio, with call-ins or TV, thoroughly believe me. The ones who have experienced fear in one way or another, maybe not as much as me, or had as awful things have happened to them that happened to me, do understand it. Those who have no fear can understand it readily. And the others are kind of hesitant, but after speaking to me or something, they seem to understand what did happen.
Do you think your experience is at all typical of other women who have been in pornographic movies?
Well, all I can base it on is that I was a victim, and I was considered the queen of pornography, you know. And if I was a victim, and there's got to be others out there, I really believe that. Yeah. I mean, you hear now so much about women abuse, you know, where husbands have been beating their wives and it's finally coming out, and child abuse and other things like that. Oh, I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Can you tell us how you first met Chuck Traynor, who's the person who basically, you say, forced you to do the movies?
Well, he held me prisoner.
And, yeah.
You know, literally held me prisoner. I was recuperating from my automobile accident at my parents' house, and a girlfriend brought him over and introduced me to him. And when I first met him, he came off like a gentleman. He was very considerate of me and what I wanted to do and how I felt about things. And when I was ready to go back to New York and back into the boutique business, which I had been doing before I had my car accident, he made a complete 180 and started really, you know, that's when the beatings began. And soon after that, the sexual abuse.
Linda, I just want to take out a moment and say to our audience who's listening now that we're going to be talking fairly personally, well, as personally as you're willing to talk. And I just want to say that if anyone feels that they're going to be offended by hearing talk about X-rated films or sexual abuse, that you might want to switch your station, because we will be talking pretty frankly for the next while on Fresh Air. So that's just notice for people who do not want to hear mm-hmm. the kinds of subjects we'll be talking about. You said that when Chuck met you, you know, he you had sexual relations together. And the feeling that I got from reading your book was that he got more aroused by beating you than by just having normal lovemaking.
Now I understand how far you want to go. In Ordeal, I get into the explicit things that happen. And that's the reason another reason I wrote it, so that I wouldn't have to recapture the whole thing again. Unfortunately, what you say is true, but I feel he I'm not a psychiatrist, but I feel he definitely has a hatred to his mother and therefore takes it out on other women. I tend to believe that anyone involved in pornography has a definite hatred for women. We've gone from Deep Throat, which was a very chic movie to take your wife to, or your girlfriend to child pornography, where the youngest victim is 17 months old, to snuff movies, where they actually beat a woman to death and commit murder on film, and they're getting paid for it and getting away with it. What's next? Are they going to hang women's hides on the side of the road for those who get a kick out of that? You know, I thought Hitler died a long time ago.
Did you have any sense of how to cope with this? Because it was probably that kind of association of brutality and sexuality was probably really new to you and very confusing and baffling as well as terrifying. Did you have any mechanisms to cope with that or any support to turn to?
No, there was no support groups to turn to. If there were, I don't really know if I could have gotten to them. Maybe on one of my escapes, rather than if I had had the knowledge before, I wouldn't have gone to my parents. I would have gone to a group of people which would have protected me. I don't know. It's a difficult thing. I learned quite rapidly to turn off my own emotions and my own feelings, and everything that was happening around me. I was actually functioning as a robot at that time. And I thank God that I had that ability, because if I hadn't been able to turn off all those feelings, I think I probably would be in a mental institution today, because what happened was really horrifying and devastating.
You write the story of how you went to your parents' house. You were able to escape from Chuck for a while. You got to your parents' house. And can you tell us what they did, what your mother said when you got there?
Sure. It hurts it breaks my heart, you know, really. It to this day, I really can't figure it out why she did it. But I had gotten away from Mr. Traynor. I was at my parents' house for a couple of days. And my mother came in to me and told me she had talked to Chuck on the phone and that I was his wife and he was my husband. And when you're married, you must stay married forever and you work things out. You may have some difficulties in the beginning, but if you stay together, you can work them out. And I said to her, Mom, I don't think you really understand or have heard what I've said. He has put me out on the street. He wants me to do some very sick, perverted movies. You know, are you listening? And she said, well, he told me he doesn't know what came over him, and he apologizes and he promises he won't do that anymore. And I had turned around to leave my parents' house, and he was at the door. And when he came in, my mother left us alone in the living room. And my nephew managed to come into the room. He was young, very young at the time. And he pulled out a gun and threatened to kill my nephew. And I said, no, you wouldn't do that because my father's here, you know. And he says, that doesn't matter. I'll shoot each and every one of your family as they come out the door. Not in those nice of terms, but he got his point across. And I was really convinced that he would kill me and everybody else in the house.
So you went back with him because of that?
Mm-hmm.
Was there anyone else who you could turn to?
Well, on a previous occasion, that was my third unsuccessful attempt. The second attempt, I had gotten my only friend that I had in Florida to come and get me, and while I was in a hotel, and when we got to her house, he threatened to kill everyone in the house. He had a machine gun, and he was parked outside in a van with a machine gun and some hand grenades. And I couldn't live with that, you know, him killing everyone in that house because of me. And I went back to him that time, too.
Do you think he would have done it? Looking back on it now?
Yes. I mean, he used to brag about people that he killed in Mexico, and he had a friend who worked with the narcotics agency, and they used to break people's banks, and they used to give them bombs and things to blow all this stuff up with. So I know they had the stuff available to them.
What about the police?
Well, when I finally did escape out in California, I was running from one hotel to another. You know, my girlfriend Dolores was helping me at the time. She'd bring me a change of clothes and different wigs and everything to sneak me out. And I had hired bodyguards, two bodyguards for 24 hours a day, and then I ran out of money. And this is about 3 weeks of being in hiding. And I called the police department, and I told them that this man was running around town with a semi-automatic machine gun and a Walther PPK 45 automatic 8-shot. And they said, "Lady, there's nothing we can do until he's in the room." I said, "But he has no permit or license to carry these weapons." I said, "Can you at least get him on that, let alone, you know, before murder?" And they said, "Lady, there's nothing we can do. We can't get involved."
Why was that? Why can't they do anything?
I don't know. That's how they ended the conversation. That's a good question. I'd like to know that, you know? Like, a lot of people have been asking me why I haven't pressed charges against Mr. Traynor. I can't afford to press charges, but here we have our own, you know, our own society, our own system is a police department or other agencies which are supposed to protect people, and they haven't done anything. There hasn't been one local DA that's picked up the charges against Mr. Traynor.
Have these experiences made you a very political person in terms of your view of victimization?
I guess in a way they have made me that way because they've made me realize what really does go on. I was very naive and innocent to a lot of things that happened in our world. I guess through my experience I've gained a little bit of knowledge of the horrible things that go on. And I'm very concerned. I'm concerned for children. You know, there's no reason for them to view nudity and pornography and things like that. People that patronize X-rated theaters, they know what's inside. There's no reason to put explicit photographs on the outside for children to see, and not just children. There are many women and men that are insulted by that.
Which seems to you to be the greater problem, people walking into theaters and seeing explicit sex and nudity, or many women being exposed to being victimized by men and having parents like yours who say, "Well, look, he's your husband."
Well, I think they all stem out of the same thing, you know. So I was saying before, like, we went from deep throat to child pornography to snuff movies. What could be next? Maybe if that was eliminated in the beginning, the pornography was eliminated or controlled. I can understand you can't have censorship, complete censorship. Everyone has the right to choose what they want to see and do, but also, there's those who have the right that don't want to see it. If anything, I think it should be removed from the visual eye. There are a lot of people in our society that aren't mature. There's some people that could go see an X-rated movie and handle it. There are other people that go out and they commit murder or rape behind it.
And that's in this situation, the person who was committing rape was not the viewer of this movie who was aroused to commit mm-hmm. violent acts from the movie. He was the person who beat you and forced you to make it, and the mm-hmm. movie had nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, seeing the movie
yeah.
did not arouse his anger.
Who knows? Who knows how many people went to see something like that and did that? You really don't know. The crime rate of the rape crime has gone up incredibly. In New York, they're finding women's bodies that are decapitated. Out in California, they recently found 40 dead bodies of young women and roughly 500 pornographic photographs. And these two gentlemen are suspected of the whole thing. You know, and it's sinful, all the things that have been happening.
I want to get back a little later to the politics of pornography and mm-hmm. talk some more about that, but I just want to talk a little bit more about some of the experiences that you had. You quote something that Chuck Traynor says in the book when he wants you to become a whore for him. He says, "A woman's got a product, and mm-hmm. she's got to use it." And he, as you described, forced you to become a prostitute. He kept the money. Mm-hmm. And through that, you met a lot of other women who were hookers. Mm-hmm. Were you able to talk to them at all? Since I should think that they might really understand
not really.
What you were being subjected to.
Not really. There was one girl who kind of helped me. She used to tell me all these weird things to tell him to keep him off my back, making up stories about what we had done, making them sound worse than they really were, because he enjoyed that. And another girl who I had made my first attempt with came off like she was very understanding of me, and when I started to run, she called him and told him that I was running away. You know, so I guess they're all different.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense of whether other women who were prostitutes got into it in ways similar to the way you did.
So I had hard time.
You were pretty unique.
I had a very hard time associating with them because I couldn't understand that at all. I don't understand prostitution. I have a very difficult time trying to figure out why a woman would want to do something like that, you know, by choice.
So you weren't really able to communicate?
No, not really. Mm-mm. And I didn't really have the opportunity to actually talk to people because I wasn't allowed to, or he was right there beside me. I mean, I was literally a prisoner of his.
Did these experiences make you, like, hate men in general?
During that time, I hated men, sure. Very definitely.
How have you been able to get over those feelings? Have you been able to get over those feelings?
Yeah, I have. I have a beautiful son and another baby on the way, and a wonderful husband. Just a lot of inner strength, a lot of belief in God. I've found a lot of strength in God. He was the only one I could communicate during that whole time. And after I got away from him, it took a year. I was with another individual who was the total opposite, very romantic. And I think that helped me out a great deal because I was working on getting back in touch with my emotions and my true feelings and realizing that I could think for myself and I could make decisions and things like that. My husband Larry has just been terrific for me, very understanding. He's had his problems with dealing with it. I think he's like any other man whose wife has been raped, has that strong desire to get back at somebody. And I guess, you know, now he realizes through my strength, we've helped each other, you know, that's not the right way. The most important thing is to stand by your woman, not to go out and do something where you'll end up in jail.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Linda Lovelace, who's written a book about her experiences in which she describes how she was basically forced to make the movies that you know her from and to become a prostitute for a while by a man named Chuck Traynor. Did you have any pleasure during this time at all from sexuality, either with Chuck or any of the other men or women?
Not.
That did you have to, like, relearn sensual pleasure afterwards?
Like I was saying before, once I was able to get back in touch with myself and my own emotions and feelings, I became Linda again. The real Linda, the Linda that I probably would have always been if I hadn't run into a Mr. Traynor.
You describe also how, I guess it was Chuck who taught you how to do the whole deep throat business by relaxing your throat muscles.
Mm-hmm.
How did he learn that?
He learned that in Japan and taught it to me through hypnosis.
How did the film come to be, the film Deep Throat?
We were in New York at the time, and he got in touch with Jerry Damiano. Someone had told him Mr. Damiano was doing a big film, and he volunteered me, and Jerry Damiano thought it was a terrific idea. And that was it. Simple and basic. It seems that those kind of people just stick together, and there's a whole underground out there of people that they talk in a language that I wouldn't be able to understand, but that Chuck was able to figure out everything that they were saying and what this meant and what that meant and set up for the 8mm movies and then into Deep Throat.
Was the movie built around you, the theme of the movie?
Yeah, through the thing that he had taught me. And they made that the whole plot of the movie, I guess you could say.
What was your feelings around the set when you were on camera, particularly when you were having sex in front of the camera? What was happening around you? Did you feel like people in the crew would get turned on by it? It was a very matter of fact.
That's what I was saying before. During that period, I learned how to turn off everything that was going on around me, and emotions and feelings. So I wasn't really feeling anything in that way. I did feel quite upset and saddened after the first day of shooting. I had smiled on the set, and that night I got a beating from Mr. Traynor in my room. He was knocking me against walls, off of beds, and kicking me, and I was screaming for help. And the whole crew was in the next room, and nobody did anything. The greatest complaint the next day was how to cover up the bruises, and they felt that that sweet and innocent look had been destroyed because of the bruises, which upset them a great deal. Those are the only things I can relate to at that time. You know, the coldness of people, I guess, the way society just steps over somebody laying down the street and doesn't even think to help them.
You must have thought about why people could hear you screaming for help and probably hear the sounds of you being beaten from the next room and not do anything.
I can't understand that. I was beaten up in a hotel room one time. I guess I can say, well, maybe they didn't hear because of the door. You know, you can give yourself a lot of excuses or reason. I would say it was virtually impossible that they didn't hear what was going on. The next day, someone came up and said, oh, if you need any help, we'll help you. You know, but where were they the night before when I really did need the help, when I was being brutally beaten? I was in a hotel one time being dragged down a hall. And at the about three doors down was a maid and I guess the custodian or janitor of the hotel. And I was being dragged by my hair and asking them, please help, you know, if you can't help me, get someone to help me, please. And they just stood there. They literally just stood there watching and didn't do a thing.
Do you think that has to do with the fact that you were married and that for some people what goes on between husband and wife is their business, even if it's brutality, you don't mess?
Well, in this situation, I wasn't with Mr. Trainor. I was with this other man who I ended the relationship with because he didn't stand by me when producer of a movie company said it was time to take off my clothes, and it was supposed to be a PG movie, which totally, you know, I wasn't ready for that at all. I never would have believed he would have done something like that. And because I had broken up the relationship, he flipped out and was dragging me down the hall. And so we weren't married. I think even if people think that somebody's married, you got to have some kind of compassion for people. You got to become involved. I mean, how can you just stand by and watch somebody be beaten? I mean, even if it's husband and wife, mother and daughter, father and son, I have a very hard time with that. You know, if I saw somebody beating up, you know, a woman, or a child, I interfere. You know, maybe I'm wrong in that sense, but I guess because of what I went through, there were so many times I was hoping somebody would do something.
I don't think anyone would accuse you of being wrong for trying to intervene where a woman was being beaten up, no matter what the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been possible to go to Jerry Damiano or Harry Reams, your co-star in the movie, take them aside and say, you know, I was nearly murdered last night. You've got to get me out of this situation.
They didn't want to hear it because the next day they were the ones that were complaining about the bruises. That's all they were interested in. Their money-making product has now been damaged. You know, dollar signs is all they saw. They weren't seeing a human being or a person. If they had interfered, they probably would have lost their whole movie, and that's not what they wanted. You know, it's...
But they were losing dollars, too. I mean, that's the reason there. He was ruining the packaging.
Their greatest concern was that they had... Their sweet and innocent look had been lost because of bruises. That's all they were concerned about. You know, that's all they were walking around. Oh, who's got this? Well, try this kind. Oh, no, this will work better. Not, wow, Linda, are you all right? No, it was none of that. Is there any, can I help you, you know? Try to get me on the side. I mean, there was only a few moments during that period that I was away from him. He was still in visual, you know. People could have mumbled something in my ear, but that's not where they were at.
You think people assumed that you wanted it, and that if you didn't want it, you'd say something?
Well, I find that hard to believe, too, because they heard me get beaten and screaming for help, you know? And there seems like from being involved with the prostitution, that era there, you could tell the difference between me and someone else. The women that were really into it were very aggressive and came up with all the great ideas, that's what they considered, whereas I was coaxed and pushed into situations and never came up with my own great ideas like they did or was very aggressive. I was always had to have that push. I could see it with my own eyes, the difference in people. I could tell who was being, you know, pushed into a situation and who was doing it as a willing and wanting participant.
So there was no one on the crew or in the actors who you felt would have had any responsiveness?
No, the one person that did talk to me was talking about how we could make a lot of money together by doing more and, you know, bigger things in this field. It was like I guess I was aware of Mr. Trainor for a while, in a way kind of understood him. There was a great fear of, well, what is this person like? Do I make it, do I try to get away and go with this person who might be even more flipped out for all I know? Or do I stay where I am, where I'm beginning to, you know, feel out the situation and, you know, I'm getting ready to make a plan to finally, you know, escape? You know, it was like, it was hard. I didn't trust anybody, you know.
Did you feel that the people involved with the movie hated women in general?
Yeah, I really feel that way. I can't understand a person that makes these kind of movies, abuses women like this, loving a woman. You know, I have a very hard time believing that. I think there's a definite hatred for women there.
Was it expressed in any other ways besides turning their heads when you were being abused?
What do you mean?
The hatred of women.
Well, just the fact that the whole pornography thing, look what we've gotten into now, where they chain women and they put them through meat grinders and, come on. That, is that love? You know? I mean, what would a man do if they started doing that to men? And you know, I'd be interested in to see what kind of a reaction would happen if they started putting men and binding them and chains and whips and things like that. You know, maybe then there would be a stand taken or a move made. All it takes is a strong attorney general to change the whole laws on pornography. All it takes is a letter to the attorney general. If one out of 100 people did it, there would be a change.
Do you know of any men who were forced into making pornography? I was thinking about the difference.
Not really, because my whole involvement in the pornographic world was 3 weeks, you know, as far as that goes. You know, so I really, you know, I couldn't really answer that, you know, intelligently or with the right knowledge, amount of knowledge.
It would seem that a man would have to be more involved in making a movie, that a man would have to be turned on in order to, you know, do the sexual scenes, mm-hmm. whereas a woman can pretend and,
yeah,
therefore, you know, you can maybe get away easier with forcing a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good possibility. I just came from another radio show where a guy called up and wanted to know how he could get into these movies, and that floored me. It really did. How could you want? He even read Ordeal, which was even more amazing to me. He read Ordeal and still wanted to go and get involved in these kind of films. There was recently a murder in Chicago where a 12-year-old boy had, or a boy at the age of 12 had gotten involved in pornography, and at the age of 16 wanted to get out of it, and he was mysteriously murdered. You know, so I guess it happens to men, too.
You co-starred in Deep Throat with Harry Reams. Did you get a sense that he was enjoying being in the movie, or did you think he was just doing it for the money?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, most of the people that I met during those 3 weeks were into the fact that it was, you know, untaxed money, and a lot of them afterwards would all get together and go over their house, somebody's house together, and just get involved all over again. What they were doing on the film, they would do at home together. You know, so I guess both things. As far as Harry Reams, I didn't really get to know him all that well, but as an outsider, he did seem to be enjoying himself.
What about the other men? Did they seem to be in it for the money or for pleasure or both?
I guess I would say, again, for both, you know? They were all friends. They all knew each other. They all partied afterwards. And I have a very hard time understanding that. I really feel if someone who wants to be in pornography or get involved with it should see psychiatric help first. That's my personal opinion. I think there's something missing in your life if you have to resort to things like that.
Was the crew voyeuristic while the film was being shot, or were they just doing their jobs? You don't know?
I really don't know. I completely turned myself off to everybody and everything that was happening.
When you look back at the movie, I imagine you've seen it, maybe not recently, but did you feel like you looked convincing?
Well, I had never seen an X-rated movie. I ended up being in one. I had to observe it in a courtroom in Florida, which I found very hypocritical. The judge required that the film be shown for me to identify it as the true movie. And it was regarding a guy who was in the beginning at the pool scene, just walked by, you know, walked by, and he claimed that it had destroyed his life and his income. So the judge requested that the movie be filmed, and I identify it as the movie Deep Throat. The first 2 minutes is where that the boy who was suing had the lawsuit going. The first 2 minutes, his whole thing was over, but they showed the whole movie. They also took a break before, you know, they announced they were going to show it, took a 10-minute break and came back and showed it. I didn't watch the movie. I couldn't. I can't handle watching that. To me, is disgusting and revolting and a complete turnoff. I was more interested in observing this courtroom that was nearly empty, suddenly becoming jam-packed with busy attorneys and judges who took brief recesses. This is our justice. I mean, these are the people that represent justice in our society. There were a lot of things that happened that, you know, had that kind of an impact on me.
Some of our listeners may recall seeing interviews with you after the movie talking about how wonderful it was to make it and mm-hmm. how you couldn't get enough and
right.
all this.
Right.
Were you forced to do those interviews?
Yeah. Those were, in a way, harder for me, you know, than even making the film itself. Here I was talking to everyone in America and, you know, our whole country and telling them that this was terrific and wonderful. Mr. Train had certain questions that were allowed to be asked. If they weren't allowed to be asked, he prepared me for any question that could come up and told me the answer to give. And if I didn't give it the way he told me, exactly as he told me, I would get a beating. So I learned quite rapidly. By that point, I was totally functioning as a robot. But I learned quite rapidly to do what he told me to do and do it well. Excuse me, to eliminate a beating or from something else worse happening or to be put in a situation for a longer period of time. And I guess I just learned quickly to be convincing.
Once the movie became very popular and you became very famous, you had entree to the homes of other famous people who were interested in being in your company. One of those places was the Hugh Hefner mansion, and you spent time there, and from what you described, it sounded like he and Chuck Traynor, the man who basically kept you prisoner for all that time, shared a lot of pretty kinky ideas.
Well, I have a difficult time when people pick, you know, celebrities or names out of the book. To me, they're all degenerates. They all have the same desire as Mr. Traynor had. It seems that those kind of people all cling together. For 2.5 years, that's the only kind of people that I met. There was a time when I said, my God, Linda, is there something wrong with you? Are you the one that's the oddball here because you don't enjoy these kind of things? Yeah, you know, I really went through that a period like that, and I realized, no, you're not the crazy one. All these people are nuts. And it was, you know, that's an emotional thing to go through. I mean, when everyone you're meeting is as sick as the one you've known for so long.
Yeah. But someone like Hugh Hefner or the other people that hung around there, could you have told them about the victimization you were going through? See, these are people with power.
Well, this was their lifestyle, you see. I didn't change their lifestyle. Their lifestyle existed. I was an object they used. And their lifestyle still exists.
Well, from what I've seen of like the Playboy lifestyle, it always mm-hmm. seems to be associated with a lot of money, easy living, a lot of sexuality, but the brutality seems like it would be Like much sadomasochism more into a role-playing kind of thing than real violence and real imprisonment. I mean, what you were going through was real violence, which is different than just putting on leather to have sex.
Sure. No, there was, like I said, these people were all alike. I was never out of Mr. Chaney's sight.
No, but I'm saying, were they like? Because you were really the victim,
I think so.
And were the people at the Playboy Mansion just doing what they mutually wanted to do, or do you think they were really victims there? You were never consenting.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying here. I don't know. I have a hard time dividing the two. Maybe they didn't commit acts of violence, but they were doing the same kind of sexual perversions. And to me, that's enough, you know? That's what, in my opinion, makes them all alike, that they all had these same sicknesses and desires, you know.
You mentioned that people bring up the celebrities who are in your book. Well, there are two big names. One is Hefner, and another is Sammy Davis Jr., who invited you and Chuck over to the house. And after a while, you and Sammy Davis would go to another room.
Mm-hmm.
And would have sex, and he said that he wouldn't have normal intercourse because that would be cheating on his wife, so he would do other things instead. I was, I guess, surprised to see his name in the book since few names are mentioned, and it seemed to me the kind of thing where you'd have to really worry about lawsuits and things like that. What were your considerations before putting their real name in the book and not trying to make him an anonymous figure?
Because it was the truth. I, you know, put the truth in about everything, and I didn't feel that they were anybody special to be eliminated, you know. I don't know. That's basically it, you know.
You gotten any reaction from him?
No, and I don't believe I will, because I was kind to all those people in the book. I was very kind, and if they do any lawsuits or anything like that, only more is going to come out, and I don't think they want that to happen.
A few years ago, one of the kind of weird trends that we were hearing a lot about was siliconing.
Mm-hmm.
Breasts to make them larger, and Chuck made you do that.
Mm-hmm.
How, does that cause any permanent damage? I've always, you know, learning about all kinds of chemicals and the damage that it causes.
Well, they have to do some exploratory surgery, when I can afford it, to find out the damage that has been done, the muscle tissue that's been destroyed and all that. There's a great possibility that the silicone can break down and go to my through my, you know, blood into my heart and kill me. Same goes for my right leg. It's a little gory, but the two things do exist. I used to protect my body with my right leg all the time. Do you know anything about Fry boots? They have a steel plate in them, and he used to kick me with Fry boots all the time. So every one of my surface veins in my right leg is broken, and they all have to be removed. And at any moment, a blood clot can shoot from one of those and go to my heart. So I have, I guess, battle scars. Nice way of putting it.
Has Chuck Traynor read your book?
I don't know if he's read the book. I know that in the past he has written things saying that I was a stupid, gullible, naive person. He made me what he considered the perfect woman through beatings and through hypnosis and things like that. He recently just gave a release to the Washington Post to comment, and he told them that she should thank me for her one moment of glory, for it has now come to pass. So he believes that creating Linda Lovelace and making me Linda Lovelace was terrific and a glorious moment for me, and I've ruined the whole thing by telling everybody the truth. That's basically what he's saying. And in my opinion, that's basically a very sick mind.
Well, I would expect him to have a much more dramatic reaction than that to your book, since reading your book, you paint him as being a completely demonic, sick, perverted character. Someone
he'll admit it. He'll admit that. You know, so what is he going to get angry about? I'm telling the truth. I'm describing. Only thing that bothers me about the whole thing is he's going to have more of the people that he likes around him. Because a lot of people will be aware now that, oh, he's definitely out there. Let's go visit him. That's the only sad thing about the whole thing.
If you had the money, would you sue him now or file charges against him or take some action?
Well, I'm kind of hoping, again, that there'll be a local DA that'll pick up the charges and do it. because I really can't afford to. And I don't know. I'm just hoping society will take a stand and make the, you know, do what's necessary to prevent him and other people like him to go on like this.
You said that throughout the time, you really didn't have anyone to turn to, but you had a faith in God. Mm-hmm. Did you have faith through all of that?
Oh, no. There were times when in the beginning, I said, God, why are you doing this to me? You know, what did I ever do? I've always been, you know, right there, and all of a sudden, I'm going through a terrible trauma and torment. But then there were times when, through the grace of God, other things were prevented from happening. And I guess with not having anyone else to speak to but God, I did a lot of communicating and a lot of soul searching and I guess made a relationship with myself and God. And I think that gave me a great deal of strength.
Linda, how have like the men who you've been meeting on this tour reacted to you? Because I'm sure even a lot of the men who are interviewing you have seen your movie, mm-hmm. and that you've maybe been an important figure in their sexual fantasies. Mm-hmm. And here you are saying, wait a minute, I was forced into it. It wasn't at all sensual for me. It was horrible, and I had to completely make myself numb and cut off all my feelings and sensations to just live through that. Mm-hmm. And so here they are, it's the big chance to talk to you, and you're cutting yourself off from all of that experience. How have they reacted to you? What's that been like?
No one has been obnoxious or anything like that. They've all been very sympathetic and believing of the whole thing, you know, which was a great hesitancy on my husband's part and my part. You know, what is going to be the reaction? I mean, when the book was, ordeal was completed, it was like, well, should we let it go out or not? You know, are people going to just laugh and turn away or make more jokes? Or do you think they're going to accept it? And it has been accepted. And people have been very good. I get, I'd say, 50-50 in phone calls of men and women, all saying, God bless you. Thank you for your strength and courage to stand up and tell us what really did happen. I did a show from Atlanta, Georgia, in the middle of the Bible Belt. And before the show began, the guy said, well, let me apologize now. You'll probably get some rough calls because you're in the center of the Bible Belt. And I said, no problem. And most of the calls were people saying, God bless you, and saying, I've experienced fear. I know what you're talking about. Giving me different verses in the Bible to read for strength and courage. Sending me pamphlets on St. Thaddeus, the patron saint of courage and strength. You know, so it's actually been a very good reaction, and a very it's helped me a great deal.
I'm sure when you were putting together the book, you gave a lot of thought to how explicit you wanted the details of the sadism and of the bestiality and sexuality that occurred through force in your life. There's, I'm sure you had to think about the line between which you'd be revealing the facts and the line for which you'd be attracting a lot of very voyeuristic people. Mm-hmm. What went through your mind when figuring out what approach to take to telling the story of these experiences?
It was very important. I most of the time apologize for language in the book. The thing is, it's very important for people to be aware of what really did happen to me, and to be able to understand the language that I heard during my time in captivity and the type of people that were around me. I don't think it could have been done any other way without explaining that, because there are so many people, I am learning, that don't even know that in an X-rated movie, people take off their clothes. And I think society's got to be made aware of it, so that if they object to it, they can do something about it. You know, I think that it was very important so people could totally and thoroughly understand what happened.
Have you become a feminist from these experiences?
I don't know, really. I mean, what really is a feminist? I've always believed in women's rights and things like that. So to suddenly become one, I can't really say yes to that. I think I've always had certain beliefs and things.
I guess by that I mean generalizing some of the experiences and looking at other women who are victimized within society and some of the facets of society that allow the victimization to exist and that would allow someone to be hearing a man beating up his wife and not thinking that was terribly unusual.
There's definitely got to be a move taken against woman abuse and what's being done to women on these films. And I mean, the snuff movies alone where they're murdering women. I mean, do people out there really think that a woman who auditions and says, okay, I want to be murdered today?
But you know what I'm wondering, Linda? You know, the violence that happened to you didn't happen on the screen, most of it.
No.
I mean, it happened off the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that would have been happening whether you were in movies or whether you were just a prostitute. It was that movie that got you out of prostitution, wasn't it?
Actually, yeah. Unfortunately, with the notoriety came a bit of security. Nobody would have cared if Linda Lovelace had, I mean, Linda Borman had been shot and killed.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas Linda Lovelace, if she had been murdered, there would have been an investigation or something. You know?
So that's why I'm wondering why your anger is being directed at movies, which is image-making, as opposed to the real violence, the beatings that you and many other women receive in hotel rooms and homes.
Mm-hmm. I guess because we've gone from the acceptability of Deep Throat, which is the movie, to child abuse, I mean, child pornography, you know, and to snuff movies where women are beaten to death. I mean, 17-month-old baby, how can people do that? I mean, that's sad, you know, and I guess that's maybe why maybe because I have my own son and I have another child, you know, due in June, that I feel this great, you know, need to do something about that,
yeah.
You know.
So are you feeling now against all explicit sex on the screen or just all X-rated movies where someone is being a victim, where someone is making it against their will and is having to commit acts and having acts committed against them,
which they
do not want?
They did a definite, there definitely has to be something to control pornography, I think. I understand, again, about the censorship. You can't censor everybody. But there's no reason why you should walk by an X-rated theater and have to see a photograph of an explicit sex scene, or by an adult bookstore. There's no reason to have photographs outside. There's no reason why these... What I find very hard to understand, too, is a couple of years ago they made all these sex magazines put a band around them, you know, to hide the cover, to protect it from
like
children.
Oh, like a brown wrapping.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I never heard anybody say it's time to take the wrapper off, but they're not on there anymore. There's no need to put, you know, in a candy store, right, where a child comes to buy candy, a big photograph of a naked woman being bound and abused. There's no reason for that. If you want pornography, if you have to have it, put it behind closed doors. Take it away from the visual eye, from those who don't want it. You know, it works both ways, but I don't know. I get frustrated, I guess.
Are there any lawsuits that are pending from the book against you or against anybody else?
No.
Do you think there might be? Are you concerned about that?
I really don't. No.
Are you concerned about Chuck Traynor trying to get retribution against you for speaking as you have about him?
No, because he's agreed with it in the past. And just with that recent quote, he said it all over again. No, I'm not worried about any of that. And plus, I feel God's my bodyguard now, and he's not going to let anything more happen to me.
What's your day-to-day life like now?
Oh, it's terrific. I'm a very happy housewife, you know. You know, every woman's got their own thing that they enjoy. I enjoy being a wife, well, a woman, a wife, and a mother. That's very important to me. I spend my days with my son, and in the summer and the spring, we're out in the garden with flowers and vegetables, and I don't think I could ask for anything more. It's what I always wanted, and I finally have it. I had to go through torment to get there. But in a way, it was worth it, because this is what I always wanted.
Is writing the book bringing you the kind of notoriety that you thought you'd shaken?
Well, the notoriety still existed, and it was going in that same direction of them making new releases of movies and things like that. What this has done is maybe started to put an end to Linda Lovelace. You know, I'd like to see her die. I'd like for people to be aware of what really did happen to me.
You mean that whole persona?
Yeah. Everything. It should all be out, you know. It makes my life a lot easier and my husband's life a lot easier. Now that people know what really did happen rather than to look at me saying, oh, there she is, the super, what is she going to do now, you know? Now people look and understand, you know, or know what really did happen. And they know me, like where I live on Long Island now, all my neighbors like me. They've known me for a long time now, 3.5 years. And when they found out about the LL Association, the majority of them were in total shock. No, not Linda. Not the Linda we know, you know. And a lot of them have read the book and now understand a lot of other things, too. You know, understand more thoroughly what did happen. And or there were a lot of people are now taking a stand against it.
Against
to prevent pornography, you know. There's got to be a beginning to the end.
And you think that pornography is the place to start?
Yeah. I think it definitely harms our children. Not only children, I'm sure there's many women and men that get insulted by seeing naked photographs. Or photographs of women.
You met a lot of people who you thought were really sick.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get a sense, and a lot of them made, well, a couple of them made pornography or dealt with that. Did you ever get a sense of whether they got that way through pornography or like which came first for them?
No. I really don't know that. I do know that, like, the way I feel the damage is gone. I recently had a girlfriend that was out with her 14-year-old brother, and they were in a drugstore picking up something, and there was one of our, let's say, better accepted sexploitation magazines right in front of them, and it had a woman bound and being abused on the cover, and it said, "Women flirt with pain." And he turned to his sister and said, "Do women really like pain?" Now, this guy probably would have grown up, had a wonderful relationship with a woman, treated her like gold, but now this in the back of his head. Oh, wait a minute. Women like to be hit and beaten.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm sure that's not healthy.
The men who were into that, who you met, did they think women liked that? You had to do a lot of faking, which you write. You had a fake pleasure and you had a fake mm-hmm. pain. You write about how you made your whole body try to go completely numb so that you wouldn't mm-hmm. feel anything through muscle relaxation and through just every mental technique you could think of to mm-hmm. detach yourself. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't enough because Chuck would beat you if you didn't do it right. So mm-hmm. you had a fake pleasure when you were supposed to and had a fake pain when you were supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he and the other men thought that you or any other woman really was enjoying this pain? Or do you think they didn't care?
I don't think they care. That's what it is. I don't think they really cared one way or the other. As long as they got the product they wanted.
And the product included you playing the role.
Right.
Well, what are your hopes with this book? In terms of the effects it'll have on other people and what it will bring for your life?
I'd be satisfied if only one woman was saved from what happened to me. Or one woman who is going through a similar situation realizes that you can get your self-respect back and you can become a normal human being again. That to me, if there's just one, that's the ultimate.
Linda, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
For being here in Fresh Air. I've been speaking to, you know her as Linda Lovelace. That's not the name. Are you using that name now?
No, I'm Linda Marciano.
All right, okay. And she's written a book about the time that she spent as Linda Lovelace, and before that when she was basically the prisoner of a man called Chuck Traynor, who forced her to enter prostitution and also to make X-rated movies, the most famous of which is Deep Throat. Her book is called Ordeal. The publisher is Lyle Stewart. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.